We heard conflicting reports this week on the future of Foxconn's investment in Wisconsin, and we're sorting through it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A little over a year ago, the electronics giant Foxconn Technology Group broke ground in Mount Pleasant on what was promised to be a $10 billion investment with up to 13,000 jobs. So fast forward to this week when Reuters broke a story with Foxconn on the record saying the plans may be scaled back or even shelved as the company was still evaluating options for Wisconsin. We're going to slow this down and take the developments one at a time with your questions along the way at 800-642-1234. What do you think if Foxconn decides to focus on its R&D in Wisconsin and abandons its original plan to assemble LCD screens? Were you hoping to get a manufacturing job with Foxconn? Do you live in the Racine County? What are you hearing in the community from your neighbors? Call in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Sean Johnson. He's WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's sort out what we know. Is it confirmed that Foxconn is not building this factory and instead putting more desk jobs here in research and development?
I guess it depends on what we mean by factory.
Okay.
In fact, the Foxconn executive who was quoted in that Reuters report that you mentioned said specifically, quote, "In Wisconsin, we're not building a factory. You can't use a factory to view our Wisconsin investment." That was Louis Wu, a special assistant to Foxconn Chairman Terry Goh, who was quoted in that Reuters article. That said, Foxconn still says it's going to build things here. It still says that it's going to invest in Wisconsin. It still stands by this number that's the upper end of the contract that it signs with the state of Wisconsin and says that it wants to create 13,000 jobs here. But it's not going to be the type of factory that was promoted when this project was first announced in 2017. I mean, back then, former Republican Governor Scott Walker was describing the size of this manufacturing plant as being 11 Lambeau fields. I think the size was part of the selling point back then. It doesn't sound like it's going to be that from what we've heard from Foxconn, not only this week, but over the past year.
What does this mean for Mount Pleasant? Because there were 1,200 acres there for phase one of this project.
I am sure that they were watching these developments pretty closely, and local leaders there have said, look, we've been in contact with Foxconn, and everything is still a go. But if it's not ramping up as fast, if these are not blue-collar jobs, but rather research and development jobs or design jobs, things like that, a place where the Foxconn tests prototypes, it's going to have a different character workforce. So, there are just so many questions right now because the Foxconn workforce in Wisconsin right now is still small. And, we're just learning that the company plans to move away from building TVs there. And so if you're not building TVs in Wisconsin, of course, Foxconn's a giant company involved in all sorts of technology. It just raises more questions about what will be built.
So its presence in Wisconsin right now is small. Its workforce is small. Do we know how many people Foxconn has employed in Wisconsin right now?
It is fewer than 200 because they didn't meet their employment benchmark that they would have needed to hit in order to start receiving tax credits last year. So they didn't create 260 jobs in Wisconsin. Yet they created 178 jobs in 2018. Obviously a far cry from 13,000, but it is the very beginning of the Foxconn investment in Wisconsin.
We're talking with Sean Johnson. He is WPR State Capital Bureau Chief. We're looking at what is going on with the Foxconn situation as we heard news this week that Foxconn is retooling and looking away from a traditional factory and looking more toward research and development. Gathering your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sean, Governor Evers admitted, they said they were surprised by the news. Have they had conversations with Foxconn since we learned of this on Wednesday?
That I don't know. I mean, the Evers said shortly after being elected that he just wanted to be in frequent contact with Foxconn to know what was going on. I mean, that was basically his first message after winning election in November. Because remember, the election leading up to November was, from the Democratic side, pretty critical of Foxconn. And you didn't hear this from Evers, but other Democrats were saying, let's end the Foxconn contract altogether. Evers was the one in that primary who said, look, this is happening. We just need to make sure that they're a good corporate citizen. And then after he was elected, he said he wanted to stay in contact with them. Evers said that they, you know, in that statement from his Department of Administration secretary, said that they had been in contact with them and that the news that they read about in Reuters was surprising. And so we don't really know what has happened since then in terms of the administration's conversations with Foxconn. We haven't heard directly from Governor Evers himself yet.
Well, economically, is this surprising, though, because Foxconn wasn't meeting quarterly profit expectations last year. We saw component costs going up. And then iPhone sales, Apple had its worst holiday results in a decade. And this is the company that puts those together, assembles those. So should we be surprised here?
Well, we've heard for a long time that it's hard, if not impossible. I mean, before we knew anything of Foxconn's plans to build in Wisconsin, we'd known for a long time that people were not building televisions in North America for a variety of reasons, the supply chain, the labor costs, et cetera, that it was more economically, you know, it was cheaper to build them in Asia. And so what Foxconn described, Mr. Wu described in that Reuters article was kind of reiterating market principles that had been in play for a long time. I mean, he said that it's cheaper to build these screens in Japan or China and then have them assembled in Mexico than it is to build them in the United States. So so in a way, that shouldn't be a surprise. But remember, this is far different from what was discussed when the Foxconn project was being promoted back in 2017. I mean, this was going to be a return of television manufacturing to North America. And, you know, we've kind of seen that the company start to move away from that a year ago when it said it was no longer going to build the biggest big screen TVs, that it couldn't get, the plate glass to Wisconsin in order to do that. And now the company is saying, you know, in terms of TV, there's no future for us in the U.S.
So very quickly, as we wrap up here, what are you watching for as you look ahead at this development?
I guess just more concrete developments on what Foxconn is going to build, what Governor Evers hears from the company. I mean, Foxconn did come out with a list of projects yesterday that it said it was going to build, a liquid crystal module back-end packaging plant, precision molding factory, other, pieces of the Foxconn business, but not the piece that they had talked about a couple years ago.
Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Sean Johnson is WPR State Capital Bureau Chief. We're continuing to talk about the news this week that Foxconn plans to focus on research and development jobs in Wisconsin. Reuters reported Wednesday that Foxconn is evaluating its options and citing steep labor costs for building screens in the U.S. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're breaking down news from Foxconn on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Foxconn said in a statement this week it remains committed to the project, the creation of 13,000 jobs, and, quote, to our long-term investment in Wisconsin, unquote. But the Taiwanese electronics giant went on to say that the global market that existed when the project was first announced in 2017 has shifted, and that means it's adjusting plans for all projects, including Wisconsin. How are you involved in the business of Foxconn? Do you run a company or work for a contractor building the factory? Are you involved in the site surveying or planning of the roughly 1,200 acres that the factory complex was slated to be built on? What do you make of this news? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Corrine Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So let's say that Foxconn ultimately does not manufacture LCD screens at its Mount Pleasant facility. The upside for Wisconsin is that its incentives package is contingent on what Foxconn actually delivers. There are clawbacks, but there are still people who have a lot to lose if this doesn't pull through. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So, I mean, Racine County in general has already spent a lot of money. Like you said, Foxconn would have to reimburse them, but, I mean, municipalities have already spent millions of dollars to prepare for Foxconn with their infrastructure. But there's others as well. Two hospital systems, Aurora and Frederick, have already decided to put hospitals near the Foxconn development site in anticipation of this. Technical colleges have begun training students, and developers have also purchased land to be near the Foxconn site. So a lot of people have made investments.
How far along are these investments? At what stage are these developments?
Well, I mean, everything is sort of at different stages. Like I said, there's developers that have purchased land. Both Aurora and Frederick have announced plans for hospitals down in Racine and Kenosha counties, very close. I mean, the areas are growing anyway, but Foxconn was the reason for this. And the infrastructure, I mean, they've been doing road work down there for the last 18 months to prepare for Foxconn.
Right. So transportation-wise, lots of movement there on roads, which is infrastructure, which is costly.
Very, yes.
So how has Racine County reacted to the talks about the facility that's going on here? What are you hearing?
Well, this week, Racine County, the county's economic development group, and Mount Pleasant all released a joint statement saying that they understand Foxconn's need to be nimble with the world market, and that they're still anticipating a large manufacturing plant as planned originally. They believe Foxconn will meet its obligation to the state and Racine County. So they think everything's going to work out.
How had they counted on this facility to manufacture TVs?
I think, like everyone in the state, they were counting on a facility for the jobs it would bring. All along, Foxconn officials and former Governor Scott Walker were saying there'd be 13,000 jobs statewide, and many of those jobs would be in manufacturing.
Go ahead.
Like Sean said, that's really how this project was sold, was for the manufacturing jobs.
You've reported that Gateway Technical College, which is a technical college in southeastern Wisconsin, had developed a curriculum in anticipation of the manufacturing jobs that Foxconn would bring. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Last year, Foxconn asked Gateway to develop this curriculum. So Gateway has two programs. One's for advanced manufacturing, the other is supply chain management. There's about 50 students total in the classes. Milwaukee Area Technical College also has developed a program based on Foxconn's request. The students never have been required to go to work at Foxconn, and there's also the upside that there's such a high demand for people in the manufacturing industry statewide that these students are likely to find a job when they graduate.
We're talking with Corey Hess. She's a reporter for WPR's Milwaukee Regional Office. We're talking about the news out of Foxconn this week that it will focus more on research and development in the face of changing market conditions. Corey, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett has responded to the reports about Foxconn changing its plans. Tell us what he said.
Mayor Barrett said he was very disappointed to hear the news that the focus might be more on research and development and not entry-level jobs. He said that Foxconn was agreed to in southeastern Wisconsin, particularly because of the large number of unemployed and underemployed people living in Racine and Milwaukee. So, you know, all along they've been talking about, I know in Milwaukee, how to get people to the jobs in Foxconn, and so they were really counting on these entry-level jobs.
Let's go to Mary joining us from Ashland. Mary, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm calling because my friend in California has been telling me about 5G research, and it's possible that, you know, the speed of new technology development points in the direction of 5G, which is being led by China. And I know that Foxconn is a Taiwanese company, but still, it would be interesting if Foxconn decided to do research on 5G.
Mary, thanks. Do we know what kind of research they would be doing here, Corey?
I'm actually not sure what kind of research they would be doing. No, I'm sorry.
Foxconn said last year it had plans to house its North American headquarters in downtown Milwaukee. Do we know if those plans may be affected?
You know, that office building is supposed to be for an innovation center, incubators, and venture capital activities. So you would think that that wouldn't be affected. In talking to the mayor earlier this week, he had not spoken to Foxconn officials yet. I'm not sure if that has changed. And I'm also not sure, you know, if they're still planning to call that a North American headquarters. So that's something to be watching for.
Were there developers that had counted on building out spaces to accommodate the thousands of workers Foxconn said it would employ at its facility?
Yes, many. You know, the mayor of Racine said that for the last 10 years or more, no developers were interested in the city of Racine, and now they've just come flocking. So, I mean, I've interviewed people from as far as California who've been purchasing abandoned buildings in downtown Racine, hoping Foxconn could revitalize that city. This Foxconn development is going to be in Mount Pleasant, but that's, you know, just a suburb, really, of Racine. And so this week I talked to two developers, one from Chicago, another from Milwaukee, who've been buying large parcels of land in anticipation of Foxconn. Both still believe the company's going to do what it originally promised. And I think they're still moving forward with their plans.
So you've seen speculators swooping in here, and now this news could perhaps upend that. Have the people you talked to truly internalized that Foxconn may not deliver on what it had originally promised?
No, not at all. But I think that the news has been so up and down this week. I mean, as Sean was telling you too, the Reuters report came out, and then Foxconn immediately responded. And so I think a lot of stuff is up in the air right now about what is going to be happening.
How much could this cost Wisconsin? Are there any estimates or dollar figures? Of course, there are clawbacks to the promise and what is attached to jobs. But as you have been telling us, there are all these other costs. What might this amount to for taxpayers?
You know, so far, the municipalities have spent about $100 million on land acquisition, and they've spent almost $1 billion on just other improvements down in Racine County. But I believe that if nothing happens, Foxconn does have to repay the local municipalities. That's part of the contract. How long all of that would take, who knows? I mean, the thought is that all of this money is being spent now, but then the municipalities get it back with the development. You know, the taxes made off the development pays municipalities back. So, I mean, there are protections, but that's all if nothing happens. And nobody has said that nothing's going to happen. This is just changes.
So, Corey, what will you be watching for as things unfold here?
Well, one thing to watch for is this ongoing lawsuit right now between an environmental group that's representing six entities and the Department of Natural Resources. There's water being diverted from Lake Michigan to Foxconn, and this change now has the group saying that if there's not as much manufacturing going on, Foxconn does not need the water at all. So that's one thing to watch for, and then also just to find out next steps with what's happening with Foxconn.
Well, Corey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Corey Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. We've been talking about the news this week that Foxconn is looking to shift its focus to R&D in Wisconsin instead of manufacturing LCD screens. Up next, it's news. Then we turn to a guest from Wisconsin Emergency Management to look at how Wisconsinites did during the polar vortex. Did you have to go outside? Did you stay warm? Did your furnace struggle? Did your pipes break? Call in 800-642-1234. The lines are open for you. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Icy roads, stalled cars, frozen pipes. We're looking at Wisconsin's emergency response to the polar vortex. You're with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The deaths of at least eight people in the Midwest are believed to be connected to the streak of extreme cold and icy weather in recent days. Hospitals treated an influx of frostbite. How did you manage this life-threatening cold spell? Did your pipes break? Did your heater struggle or stop? Did the power go out? Did you work in a warming shelter in your community over the past few days? How did you provide support for people who needed a safe and warm place to go? We're at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your situation in an email, ideas@WPR.org. Lori Getter is a spokesperson for Wisconsin Emergency Management. Lori, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Well, let's look at this broadly. How did Wisconsin fare during the outbreak of dangerous temperatures and wind chill?
I think people in Wisconsin did a great job. The media, public service agencies, first responders, volunteer groups really got the word out early on over the weekend and late last week that we were going to have this bitter cold and some heavy snow on Monday and bitter cold. And I'm really proud to say that Wisconsinites, you know, met the warning. They checked on their neighbors, checked on their friends, took those extra precautions, and I think that's why things went so well. We did have a few deaths, unfortunately, but again, people really took this seriously.
What do we know about the deaths from the severe weather?
Well, again, we don't know yet. There's still autopsies pending, but what we've seen in past cold weather cases is they are usually senior citizens or people with medical conditions, especially heart disease or asthma, that may be out there shoveling and breathing that cold air or the exertion. So we'll learn more about these cases. But again, it comes down to making sure you check on your friends, check on your family, make sure everyone's okay.
So Wisconsin declared a state of emergency. Our neighbor Minnesota did not. Was the National Guard needed in this situation?
The reason why Governor Evers declared was very proactive in declaring a state of emergency is basically to make sure all state resources, including the Wisconsin National Guard, if needed, were ready to be deployed. But fortunately, our communities didn't need any assistance. But during emergencies, every minute counts, and we just wanted to make sure we were prepared to provide any assistance that our local governments may have needed.
When did Wisconsin first hear about and start preparing for the polar vortex? When did the wheels really start turning?
It actually started a week ago Thursday. We received some information from the National Weather Service that there was a chance to have bitter cold temperatures that included record-setting wind chills. And so that obviously perked up, and we were busy on the phone with the National Weather Service. That led to communicating with our county and tribal emergency management directors and first responder groups. And so it was a busy few days before the systems actually started to hit Wisconsin.
We're talking with Lori Getter. She's a spokeswoman for Wisconsin Emergency Management, talking about the reaction to the polar vortex, how the state fared. How did you do during the cold weather? Did your pipes break? Did your furnace struggle or stop? Did the power go out? How have you been managing the challenges of severely cold temperatures? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. And parents and caregivers, schools have been closed for days now. How are the kids in your life doing? Have they been frustrated to not be able to go outside? And how did they stay busy? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Lori, going back to the state of emergency during the past few days, the National Guard not needed in the situation, but when a state of emergency is declared, what exactly does that entail?
Well, basically what that means is that there is an incident underway, or such as a tornado or flood, or potential for a very serious incident, such as in this case. And basically what a state of emergency does is orders state agencies, including the Wisconsin National Guard, to be ready to assist any community that needs assistance, whether that is National Guard assets, it could be assets from other state agencies. During the flooding, we had a lot of different organizations, including correctional inmates that were used to help fill sandbags. So it just depends on what is needed. But again, it heightens the seriousness of the situation. And this was a very serious situation. This was deadly wind chills that were going to hit the state. And so, again, we wanted to make sure we had all the assets that the state has ready to assist local communities. Fortunately, again, communities were able to handle it. First responders did a great job, as well as did utility companies and everyone who had to work outside to help keep our citizens safe.
Well, part of being prepared for a weather emergency is having supplies in your home. Chris in Adams has thoughts on that. Chris, hi.
Hi, I want to put a positive spin on this. I went out in advance of the snowstorm and bought a whole pile of really great food and wine, and I have been hunkered down cooking up a storm. I also have been really, really enjoying my amaryllis, which are blooming, and my orchids, which are blooming, and I wanted to send kudos out there because I live in a great neighborhood. All of the neighbors came together to shovel everybody out and charge cars and do the great thing for people. And the birds are eating me out of house and home, and I want to give a piece of advice to everybody, because your screener said to me that she was getting cabin fever. The Olbert Gardens is sponsoring the Madison Orchid Show this weekend, and the weather is going to be nice. And if you have the need, it's not only a visual, it's smells so good.
Absolutely. Good for your senses. Chris, I have to ask, though, what did you cook during the storm?
Oh, you're not going to want to know. I made a pork roast with a honey orange glaze, Brussels sprouts, apples in a sherry sauce with mushrooms and onions and stuff, and lots of fresh rosemary.
Nice.
And then I made sautéed salmon and shrimp with hollandaise sauce and linguine, and I'm a gourmet cook.
I love it. Chris, thank you so much for that. And Lori, it sounds like Chris was really living it up indoors.
He did. And that's wonderful. I mean, this is wintertime in Wisconsin, and, you know, one of the things we love about our state are the four seasons, and I want to go to her house, because I think I had chicken soup or something for one of my meals. But she did bring a good point up, talking about that she, you know, went to the store and stocked up. And one of the things that we're always encouraging people to do is to make sure you have emergency kit in your house. Now, I'm not talking salmon and pork loins, but what I'm talking is having items in your house in case you should lose power. The crews did a great job getting power restored to those communities that lost power. But, you know, having those items prepared, also having emergency kits in your vehicle in case you were to get stuck, because it is going to take crews a while to get to you. And one other point she did make is everyone helping each other, and that's really the Wisconsin spirit. you know, everyone helping the shovel. And that was one of the messages we really pushed this past week, is helping your neighbors, checking on your friends, checking on elderly neighbors, you know, keeping people, just checking up on them, making sure everyone's okay. And so that's great. I'm very happy.
Do we have any numbers on how many people lost power and for how long?
You know, that's really hard to determine. Mm-hmm. We did hear several cases of, you know, a couple thousand here, a couple thousand there. The problem is the state has many co-ops as well as the major utilities as well. So it's hard to, you know, get a handle on that. But we did have power outages. The good news is most of those communities that didn't have power, they're immediately a shelter was open. Example was in Cumberland. They had a power outage, and I think it lasted about 4 hours. They opened up a church right away, and so people had a place to go. The first responders were helping people if they needed a ride there. So communities really, you know, answer the challenge to this polar vortex. I mean, opening shelters, keeping shelters open. So they did a great job.
Was Wisconsin's electric grid taxed here?
Well, I'm not the one to answer that, but I think that, you know, I think obviously the furnaces were going full speed this past week, but again, our utility companies did a great job. And again, when there was power outages, for whatever reason, the crews really, you know, braved that bitter cold and got the power back on as quickly as possible. And also thanks to the first responder communities and the volunteer groups for opening numerous shelters across the state. On my desk, I would get emails all the time about new warming centers or warming shelters that were opened up. So, and they had plans in place. It wasn't just at the spur of the moment. But again, you know, the state did a great job in trying to help people and keep them warm and safe.
Wisconsin has cold weather, but this was highly unusual. What did your team learn from this emergency?
I think it's something we always learn, is being prepared and, again, continuing to communicate. I think what helped us was the early notification to get information out to the first responders, to county and tribal emergency management. And I think it's something we, you know, we'll learn. We'll still need to do an after-action report later on to see what, you know, things we could have improved on. But, you know, there was at least one death, and so that's sad. And so we need to learn from that. What happened? What can we do better to get messaging out to help people for whatever reason didn't heed those warnings?
So is there anything in the short term here, as you look back at this polar vortex, that you can change right away or something you can learn from?
I think it's still messaging to the public. Again, telling people what's going to be happening and encouraging people to be prepared, to have emergency kits at their home and their vehicle, have that emergency plan. And again, to have that community in your neighborhood, making sure you're able to help people. And to be honest, right now, we're starting to look forward or looking forward to what's going to be our next emergency. And I don't mean that happily, but we have a lot of snow on the ground, and we're going to have some warm temperatures and potential rain and freezing rain. And what is that going to mean? You know, it's going to mean some icy roads. There could be some ice jams, especially along the Rock River. And if this snow should melt quickly, you know, we could have some flooding issues, which is really awful in the wintertime because there's no place for that water to go with the ground frozen.
Lori Getter stays with us from the Wisconsin Emergency Management. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we debrief on the polar vortex that was. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show as we look back at how we got through this last week with Mother Nature bringing us record-smashing cold from the Arctic. Let's find out how Wisconsin farms made it through the deep freeze. It is the nature of the work. Farmers often spend at least some portion of their workday outdoors or in unheated buildings. We want to find out how livestock were kept safe in this deep freeze. You can share your story at 800-642-1234. Do you work on a farm? How did you exercise horses? How did you cut down on the drafts in the barn? How did you keep your cattle water thawed? What did you do with your cattle? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Lori Getter stays with us. She's spokesperson with Wisconsin Emergency Management. Now let's bring in Dr. Eric Rooker. He is a veterinarian at Dairy Doctors Veterinarian Service in Plymouth and a member of the Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association. Dr. Rooker, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me today.
Well, what is the effect of severely cold temperatures and wind chills on farm animals?
Well, farm animals generally, when we work at Dairy Doctors, we work with dairy cattle and some beef cattle. So those animals can exist in a comfortable environment between 25 to 65 degrees. So they're used to some of the normal average temperatures we see in the winter, but these extreme temperatures that we've seen in the last 3 to 5 days here have really kind of taken a toll on the farmers themselves as well as the animals. Luckily, through some good training and husbandry taking care of the animals, our clients have been able to weather the storm, without a pun intended there. Those animals can weather that storm when we provide them with good bedding and a windbreak to basically keep them out of the elements. Several of our clients actually have facilities where the animals are in a, you know, enclosed building, and that building, believe it or not, is held just below freezing. I was in one yesterday that was 27 degrees, so I was sweaty while I was doing herd check, and the cows were comfortably eating, laying down and resting. So they can definitely weather a storm like this. It's not the easiest thing to do, but they can weather through it pretty well.
What about bedding and hydration? How do you keep that correct in these types of conditions?
So bedding can be very difficult. A lot of our clients planned ahead. They fed animals for basically 2 days worth of feed to make that easier on them, so they wouldn't be exposed to as much extreme there. They bedded them extra deep, so twice or three times as much bedding, to provide them some insulation and an area to bed down and nestle in and insulate themselves. And as far as water is probably the most challenging thing I would say farmers would say in this cold. Keeping fresh water that the animals can drink and access without ice over the top is very challenging. I'm sure there's been many thousands of gallons of hot water buckets dumped into waters to break ice or thaw them out. Luckily, many of our farms are going to have water heating elements in the water to keep that water accessible to the animals. But definitely fresh water to these animals in a cold Arctic vortex like we had is probably the most difficult thing for people as well as animals.
Can there be any lasting effects of the polar vortex on large animals? For instance, for dairy cattle, can it impact production of milk?
Certainly, most certainly. Just like in people, the young and the old are most affected in dairy cattle. So calves are our primary concern in cold like this. Again, bedding them really deep so they can insulate and nest down. We actually provide them jackets to keep them warm and comfortable through all of this. We also provide them usually an additional feeding to two feedings a day to give them some extra energy to basically provide warmth to their bodies. And older animals also, just like people, suffer arthritis, generalized medical conditions. Those are the things that we kind of see in the cold like this. Those are the severely affected ones. As far as the normal production animal, day-to-day healthy animal, we'll see a small drop in production, in milk production, or even in your beef animals, you'll see a small drop in rate of gain because they do burn extra calories. The body shifts to increase the heat produced. And that instead of going to production in milk or growth is going to produce heat to keep the animal at a sufficient body temperature.
We're talking with Dr. Eric Rooker about how livestock and farmers fared during this dangerously cold polar vortex. We're talking large animals here, but Lori Getter of Wisconsin Emergency Management, let's talk about pets for a moment. How did pets do during this emergency?
I think also with the messaging, a lot of people brought their pets inside because dogs and cats are very susceptible to frostbite. And so I think everyone really heeded the warning and brought their pets inside and took those extra precautions.
And people also put out extra bird seed. As Chris said, our caller, she said the birds were just going crazy for the seed.
They were. And, you know, Mother Nature is impressive. And this morning at my own house, the birds are out and they're hitting my bird feeders. And I did put out extra bird seed, as many other people did. And so, you know, wildlife knows what to do when there's these extreme temperatures and they're able to hide and take care of themselves.
Dr. Rooker, you know, meanwhile, winter continues. We have a drastic shift in temperatures now. What tips would you like to leave people, farmers, people with livestock, when it comes to caring for cattle in, you know, weather extremes and shifting weather conditions?
One of the primary problems that they're going to see is pneumonia in their young animals. Lots of barns have been closed up tight so they don't freeze, and a lot of times what we see from clients of ours is that those barns stay tight, frozen, or stay nice and tight and sealed for a little bit too long. So I would encourage people, as the temperatures start to thaw out and we approach that 40-45 degree mark early next week, start opening those buildings up a little bit, increase the air quality, and you can continue, you know, feeding the higher level nutrition for a couple days past to catch the animals back up in terms of growth and production. Keep that energy level high and help them to catch back up after they weathered the storm.
Lori, as people get outside now and look around their own homes, their own dwellings, and their cars, what should they watch for as they regroup after this, polar vortex?
Well, you want to make sure, obviously, that all your vents are clear, which is very important. And, the best thing you can do is, if you asked me earlier, what did we learn? People should talk about what did they learn and what would they do differently. And, again, maybe having some disaster kits, having some items on hand in case they were to lose power, making sure their carbon monoxide detector was working. You know, so a lot of things that everybody has learned. But again, we now need to move forward to what our next emergency may be and to be ready for what next thing could happen.
Dr. Rooker, do you see farmers pretty well prepared even for extreme weather like this?
Most certainly. Most of our clients have seen, not as extreme as the last 2 days in the last 5 years, but they have seen extremes like this before. 2, 3, 4 days in advance, they're already preparing the equipment. Like I said, some of them are feeding animals 2 days in advance just to make sure that they can access feed. You never know what's not going to start in the cold like this. So they're feeding in advance, bedding them in advance. They are very well prepared, and they kind of know on their operations what could be an issue, and they're doing their best to prevent that. Obviously, you can't prevent everything, but they're usually well prepared.
Lori, as we wrap up, any last pieces of advice that you would have? Because as you look ahead here with this wild swing in temperatures, how are you gearing up for that, and what are you watching for there?
Well, we're watching for potential flooding, believe it or not. We have a lot of snow on the ground. If we have warm temperatures and rain, that water's going to melt and the ground's frozen. So we're not, you know, that could impact some of the rivers and creeks. We're also looking at potential ice jams, so we're monitoring those as well. And we could have temperatures going back below zero again. So this is winter in Wisconsin, so we just need to be prepared. And the Weather Service, I have to give big kudos to. They did a great job in keeping us informed throughout this polar vortex and basically all the time throughout the year about what systems are moving into Wisconsin. So the more warning we can have, the better we can prepare to be ready to respond.
Lori, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Lori Getter is Crisis Communications Manager with Wisconsin Emergency Management. And Dr. Rooker, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me today.
Dr. Eric Rooker is a veterinarian at Dairy Doctors Veterinarian Service in Plymouth and a member of the Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association. Just ahead, the Milwaukee County Zoo has a new groundhog who will make his debut in time for tomorrow, Groundhog Day. We'll learn more about him and about the history of this holiday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.